Hi, and welcome to episode 13 of the Unpacking Weight Science podcast called Insights into Hayes Adoption from the Diffusion of Innovations Theory. I'm your host, Fiona Willer, weight neutral professional development dietitian, academic and size acceptance advocate. One of my favourite theories of social science is the diffusion of innovations theory. It so beautifully explains how new ideas spread through social groups and populations. The adoption of intuitive eating and health at every size by individuals and by health and counselling professionals has followed the predictable patterns laid out in this theory. This episode, I'll be running through these characteristics and importantly, showing you how you can recognise where someone is on their path towards Hayes adoption and how you can most effectively nudge them towards their decision making. Our learning goals for today are to identify the adopter characteristics as described in Rogers' Diffusion of Innovation Theory, identify the innovation characteristics which contribute to the adoption decision process, and recognize the cues for adopter categories and innovation characteristics which increase the likelihood of adoption of Hayes and size acceptance approaches. So, the diffusion of innovations theory is a model that explains how new ideas spread and how new things are adopted by people. It explains the types of people that spread ideas, the types of people that pick up new ideas, and the characteristics of those new ideas that make them sticky or not sticky. It was first developed in the field of agricultural science and the spread of new agricultural technologies, so ideas as well as equipment. And the man at the centre of this work was and is Everett Rogers. He first published about it in 1962 and last published about it in edition 5 of The Diffusion of Innovations Theory in 2003. It's a fabulous read, and I've now bought 3 copies of it after my father ran off with my first one and my son ran off with and then lost my second copy. And my third copy has a space all of its own on top of my office shelf where no one else can get it. It's a really easy read. It's great. Rogers was looking at agricultural practices and noticed that new practices were adopted most readily when they were endorsed by another farming friend or competitor. He looked at the characteristics of the innovation, the idea, the practice, or the equipment, and he looked at the characteristics of the people adopting the new things and the characteristics of those who hadn't adopted the new thing yet. And he looked at that decisional balance, what the process was that a person went through in order to decide whether or not to try a thing and then whether or not to keep doing the thing. So the official explanation is this. The diffusion of innovations theory is one of the oldest social science theories. It originated in communication to explain how, over time, an idea or product gains momentum and diffuses or spreads through a specific population or social system. The end result of this diffusion is that people, as part of a social system, adopt a new idea, behaviour, or product. Adoption means that a person does something differently than what they had previously, for example, purchase or use a new product, acquire and perform a new behaviour, etc. The key to adoption is that the person must perceive the idea, behaviour, or product as new or innovative, and it's through this that diffusion is possible. So the important points here are newness and social system. And I want to recognise at this point too, before we get into the nitty-gritty, that everyone is usually part of multiple social systems. So there's an element of dualism with this stuff. So you can be super keen to adopt Hayes and intuitive eating into your professional life, but less ready to adopt it for yourself and vice versa. And you'll be able to see in the categories as I go through them why that could be the case. All right, so the theory of diffusion of innovations comes with a conceptual map of the adoption of this new idea through a social system. And so if we think about full adoption as being 100% adoption, everyone in that social system has adopted this new thing. Think about iPhones, for example, certainly in Western countries, maybe if we think about smartphones, virtually everyone in the population has got their own or access to a smartphone these days. So we've got almost 100% penetration of the market of this idea of this new innovative product, smartphone, that did not exist 20 years ago. So if we think about that 100% penetration mark there, when something's being adopted through a social system, the first 2.5% or so of adopters are termed the innovators. So these are people who want to be the first to try the innovation. They're venturesome and they're interested in new ideas. And these people are very willing to take risks and are often the first to develop new ideas. So very little, if anything, needs to be done to appeal to this population. So these are not necessarily the people who came up with this stuff, but they're the people who take it up straight away initially. Then the next 13.5% are termed early adopters. So these are people who represent opinion leaders. They enjoy leadership roles and embrace change opportunities. They're already aware of the need to change and so are very comfortable adopting new ideas. Strategies to appeal to this population include how-to manuals and information sheets on implementation. They don't need any information to convince them to change. So they're the early adopters. I would count myself as one of these early adopters. Next, we have the early majority. So about 34% of the population may fall into the early majority. And these people are rarely leaders, but they do adopt new ideas before the average person. That said, they typically need to see evidence that the innovation works before they're willing to adopt it. And strategies to appeal to this population include success stories and evidence of the innovation's effectiveness. So these first three categories, the innovators, the early adopters, and the early majority, they make up 50% of the population here. Next, we move to the late majority, 34%, so another standard deviation away from the mean here. And these people are skeptical of change and will only adopt an innovation after it's been tried by the majority. Strategies to appeal to this population include information on how many other people have tried the innovation and have adopted it successfully. And finally, the last 16% of the population are termed laggards. So these people are bound by tradition and very conservative. They're very skeptical of change and are the hardest group to bring on board. Strategies to appeal to this population include statistics, fear appeals, and pressure from people in the other adopter groups. Now, unfortunately, as I'll talk about a bit later as well, laggards tend to also have positions of power. So they're quite socially conservative. They may be political leaders, also have very entrenched positions in our professional associations or the top of research groups, etc. So even though they are only 16% of the population, unfortunately, are disproportionately powerful in terms of their influence on others. There are four stages of innovation adoption. So first of all, there's this awareness of the thing and the awareness of the need for the innovation. So in terms of Health at Every Size and Intuitive Eating, this awareness is raised by colleagues and through the media and through research publications that there is a new thing on the scene and spreads the word that this may be a thing that you might want to think about adopting and makes the case that there's a need for it. The second step is the decision to adopt or to reject the innovation or the thing. And I'm going to pull this step apart a little more in a sec. Thirdly, there's trial. So initial use of the innovation to test it out, to see how it fits, to see if it feels right, to see how easy it is or how hard it is. And finally, the fourth step is the adoption. So that means the continued use of the innovation. So in diffusion of innovations theory, it's not enough that something is used just once. Adoption is considered to be the continued use of the new thing. So the innovation has been adopted fully. And I'd like you to consider these stages of the innovation adoption here, awareness, the decision to adopt or reject, the trial and the adoption, from both your perspective, potentially as a clinician, deciding whether or not you want to use a weight neutral approach in your practice with your client base. And also think about it from a client's perspective in terms of deciding to adopt this model of self-care. And perhaps that's you as well, deciding whether you're going to adopt this for yourself or not. So there's a few different layers, a few different perspectives you can use this theory in. Now we know that educators and peers are key in influencing practice adoption. So they've done some studies where they compared the influence of mass media campaigns versus the influence of social and educator influence in these social groups. And they found that the adoptions due to interpersonal communication, so word of mouth, hearing about it from a colleague or friend or family member, they're much more persuasive and much more likely to result in somebody adopting the thing than a mass media campaign that might just come through the sort of impersonal communication channels like telly and some versions of media that we get on the internet as well. So it's sort of a bit like word of mouth marketing in action. So essentially people are much more likely, if they can see the thing, somebody that they know is using it, they can see it, they can see the benefit that that other person is getting from it, and they can see the benefit that it might have in their lives, they're going to go and get the thing or have a go at using the new idea. Versus if they just hear about it in an ad on telly or some sort of public health messaging that they don't really have any connection with individually. And now these factors that influence the adoption of an innovation, so the characteristics here, and there are five. So those characteristics are relative advantage, compatibility, complexity, trialability, and observability. And each of these factors is at play to a different extent in those five adopter categories. So in those five types of people that I spoke about before, they're all going to be considering their position on this new idea through these five lenses, if you will. So your skill is being able to recognize whether your client or your colleague or your friend is in their decision-making, which stage they're in, and using the relevant characteristics to influence their skills, sort of nudging them across the line towards adopting HAZE or weight neutral practice. So those five things again: relative advantage. So that's the degree to which an innovation is seen as better than the idea, program, or product that it replaces. How much better is it at doing the thing you want to do? Compatibility, how consistent the innovation is with the values, experience, and needs of the potential adopters. Is it compatible in my life? Am I going to be uncomfortable? Is there going to be discomfort related with adopting this thing because it doesn't fit with my values? Or maybe it does. The third one, complexity, how difficult the innovation is to understand or use. Does it have face value? Can I easily access information about the thing, and do I get it pretty easily when I read about it? The fourth one, trialability, and that's the extent to which the innovation can be tested or experimented with before a commitment to adopt it is made. Can I play with it? Can I borrow the phone for a week to try it out? Can I test using weight neutral practice, non-diet approach practice with my clients a bit before deciding whether I'm going to stick it on my masthead? And the last one is observability. So the extent to which the innovation provides tangible results. What happens when I use this approach to my clients? What happens when I use this approach in my life? Like, how do I feel different? How does my health change? How do my habits change when I use this approach? And how am I observing what's going on with my colleagues and other people in my social circles when they're adopting the approach? What am I, you know, how can I see what's going on? So going through those five characteristics of an innovation now in a HAZE perspective, we start with relative advantage. So remember, this is the degree to which an innovation is seen as better than the idea, program, or product that it replaces. So we need to here emphasize the newness of weight neutral perspectives. This is both true at an individual level and drives practice adoption as well. The strategies which are consistent with supporting internal autonomy, remember our self-determination theory is part of health at every size and non-diet approach practice, we know that they're better at resulting in lasting health promoting behaviour change and better at fostering engagement in the health system and in self-care. Weight-centric care is by definition an external motivator using external goals and undermines personal autonomy. So external rules and prescription. So show the poorer performance of weight-centric approaches at these things. So you want to both highlight the relative advantage of weight neutral practice in terms of health outcomes, but also highlight the failings of the thing that you want it to replace. So demonstrate that superior performance of weight neutral approaches when compared with weight centric ones, and show what's missing in when a weight centric perspective is taken. For example, there's virtually no interest in internalized weight stigma, in body dissatisfaction and its psychological rather than physical roots. So all these things aren't serviced at all by the weight-centric perspectives. They are serviced and supported in weight-neutral perspectives. You need to make that clear. And again, emphasize that newness. That's a really important part. The second one, compatibility. So that refers to how consistent the innovation is with the values, experiences, and needs of the potential adopters. So again, reinforce the similarities in professional values. So key professional values of dietitians and nutritionists, for example, tend to be nourishment, encouraging self-care, wanting people to engage in life and their communities, delaying or avoiding chronic illness, supporting living well within the constraints of ability and disease state. And think about the values of your profession. What is the professional identity based on? What would be the least controversial way to describe your profession? And then find common ground with weight neutral practice and use those as key messages when you're talking to your peers and colleagues. Think and ask about the needs of the population and individuals you work with. If the entire population's BMI was 22, how could their health be enhanced? So what would you be doing from a public health perspective if weight as a field of interest was simply not there anymore? What would you be doing? There's that, and therein lies the common ground. The third one, complexity, so that's how difficult the innovation is to understand or use. Now, there are complex things about weight neutral practice, but there are also some easier things. But firstly, the complex weight neutral approach skills, the most complicated in my mind is that work of dismantling your own weight biases and then helping others to dismantle theirs. This is not an easy thing to do. It takes bravery to look inside and start to unpack and examine your own baggage when you're so used to helping others. And the skills to critically appraise weight-related research and the knowledge of weight-neutral research findings, that's a whole other area that you need to upskill in if you're going to do this stuff professionally. And also upskilling in non-coercive counselling skills such as motivational interviewing and acceptance and commitment therapy. So all of those things require a fair bit of time and commitment to learn how to do effectively. You can't just read a book in an afternoon and bam, you're able to do them. They need focus on professional development. But the easier weight neutral skills, and this would be the stuff to start with, you know, so people have got some goals on the board. So for example, with dietitians, just remind them all medical nutrition therapy, you already know all that stuff. And what would you do with a person who has a BMI of 22? So because, you know, weight is sort of not on the table in that context, even in a traditional weight-centric perspective. So that's a really great place to start with a person in any size of body with that particular condition. Now, of course, it doesn't take into account any of the weight stigma stuff, and that's important that we do not forget that. But it is a good place to remind people that they do know stuff. So when dietitians start to want to apply this, I sort of tend to end up throwing the baby out with the bathwater and forget that they do know stuff in a weight neutral context already. So just remind them that they're not completely clueless here. They do have some context to base stuff on initially. Unfortunately, this is because people in the normal BMI range already enjoy the privilege of weight neutrality, which means that they have then already had practice in delivering weight neutral care. The fourth one, trialability. So that's the extent to which the innovation can be tested or experimented with before a commitment to adopt is made. And so people can do this by practicing and being curious. So practice on lower weight clients first. If you're a health or counselling or fitness professional, practice there. Experiment with yourself, hold it lightly. Observe your own weight-related comments and beliefs. How do you respond to a person whose BMI is in the normal, in inverted commas, range when they bring up issues about their weight? Do you reinforce messages about fear of gaining weight? Have a think back, professionally or in your personal life, about diet talk kind of conversations, body image conversations. So with trialability, in order to move people along here, you can encourage them to talk to others who've moved from weight-centric practice to weight-neutral practice. If they're clinicians or if they're people, you can encourage them to join a support group for people who are already adopting a weight-neutral approach in their own practice, and talk to some people about how they first did it, to encourage them to toe-dip. And get in and have a go. Everyone started somewhere, and it's really the nature of this work that you have to do it in order to develop competence. It really isn't something you can just learn from a book and be able to go out fully fledged. Finally, the final characteristic is observability. So the extent to which the innovation provides tangible results. Change in weight neutral practice and weight neutral approaches must be measurable. Now, we tend to think about measuring mostly in the context of BMI and blood chemistry, unfortunately. One thing about blood chemistry is that it's not reliably changed by health behaviors or even medication. It does not respond in a dose response relationship to behaviors all the time, and neither does BMI. But we do need to measure change over time. And so you can shift monitoring of change from weight-based measures to measures of dietary quality, of eating behavior, of body appreciation, self-acceptance and compassion, quality of life, physical activity. All of these things have validated measurement tools that you can use. And ask for feedback from clients about how they feel things have changed since taking a weight-neutral approach. This is not only for your own ego to do that. This is also because it consolidates the path that these people have been on as well with you, in changing their perspectives from a weight-centric perspective through to a weight-neutral perspective. Because just as some of us clinicians struggle with figuring out how to mark change over time using a weight neutral approach, people themselves, when they have had such a myopic focus on weight and BMI for over very, very many years, do find it a little bit difficult to let go of that measure, and do need to be given something instead to hang their progress from. And also, you need to share research which shows the outcomes of weight neutral approaches with your colleagues and your clients as well. So if we do a quick whip around with those five characteristics again, the things, if you take nothing else away, the important things here: relative advantage, you want to be emphasizing newness. Compatibility, you want to be promoting benefits to the individual and drawing parallels with their own value system. Complexity, you want to practice your clarity of message, being able to explain what a weight neutral approach is in very clear, consistent, and brief terms. Trialability, you want to foster and support curiosity to continue to perpetuate people looking for different ways of doing things and making sure that what they are doing continues to support them, so that they can discard them if they're not working for them anymore. And finally, observability, you want to connect people to community where they can then see the benefits of the approach in action. So to sum up, in order to use the diffusion of innovations theory, you've got to get across a couple of arenas. First, trying to identify what kind of adopter category your person is in, and then think about those five factors that influence the decision process: relative advantage, compatibility, complexity, trialability, observability, so you can stick your message where they're going to hear it. Are they generally innovative? Are they already calling for something different or expressing that they're annoyed with the way that things are done already? And then they're probably going to be an early adopter or in the early majority in that case. And all you have to do for them is provide practical assistance to help them apply the approach. Are they wondering if they're allowed to take a weight neutral approach? Are they asking how many people are already using it and whether there are any prominent leader type people in their circles who are using it? Then they're signalling to you that they're a late majority type of person. They're probably people who have either never themselves had any issues about weight control or experiences of weight bias and discrimination, or people who have rigid eating and body control beliefs, and they may be scared or deeply uncomfortable about straying into territory where they might have to do introspective work on themselves. give these people information about who else has adopted the approach in their practice, their success stories, give them stats on effectiveness for reducing self-stigma and adoption of health-enhancing lifestyle behaviours. Once they're on board with feeling like they need to adopt it in order to keep up with their colleagues, they need some pretty consistent hand-holding to be able to take on board the complexity of the approach. And finally, if you're getting the message that Hayes is irresponsible, not part of accepted practice, or goes against practice guidelines — it doesn't, by the way, all guidelines state somewhere that the adoption of health-enhancing habits have benefits even if no weight is lost — their weight-centric interpretation of guidelines like these is a reflection of their own fat phobia and a flag that they assume that they have dominance and authority over the people they counsel or manage. So these then are the laggards. And unfortunately, they have positions of power where keeping the weight-centric status quo benefits their lives. The only way around this is to ensure that professional associations and hierarchical structures are reinvigorated by energetic early adopters of Hayes and are then able to broaden the scope of professional practice. My hot tip is that the people in the late majority and laggards are almost never also advocacy political types, so messages about social justice issues may fall flat with these people. It's not a great personality fault, but we've got to put our energies where they're most effective. The late majority are never going to march beside you holding a placard. They'll adopt Hayes in a quiet way or under extreme duress, if ever. So learn to read those signs of Hayes receptiveness in your colleagues and friends. Be loud and proud about Hayes in all of your circles, and let the viral transmission proceed. So that's it for this episode. The supporting materials, which include the show notes, research links, and self-test quiz, are available upfront for current subscribers, only $5 a month, which is a total bargain, or can be purchased in a bundle if you're catching up later. And you can see unpackingweightscience.com for details. Next time, episode 14 is Measuring Intuitive Eating: How, Why, and When. I'm going to give a brief history of intuitive eating as a thing and how it was rendered into academic research, and then talk about the intuitive eating scale, what it measures, how and when to use it, how to interpret the scores, and what has been found in research that has used it. And I've used it in my PhD research, and I'm going to talk about that experience too. So until next time, goodbye.